るいは北朝鮮のこの緊張状態に対してですね。
Japan's leader says his country needs to make some changes. We'll have the latest on a quickly called election in Japan. It's Monday, October 23rd, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, Bangladesh and Indian officials discuss the Rohingya issue.
Normalcy will only be restored with the return of the displaced persons to Rakhine State.
We'll translate that a little, and you'll hear about some controversy surrounding China's Communist Party conference.
China's very much about these days rules-based global governance, multilateralism, globalization.
It is all on today's VOA Asia.Exit polls indicate that Japanese voters have returned Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's ruling coalition to power in national elections today. On Sunday, rather, Japanese media released projections of the results shortly after the polls closed at 8 p.m. Japanese time. Abe dissolved the lower house less than a month ago, forcing the snap election. Up for grabs, 465 seats in the parliament's more powerful lower house, which chooses the prime minister. An election victory would boost Abe's chances to head his Liberal Democratic Party for another 3 years after his current term ends next September. That could extend his premiership to 2021, giving him more time to pursue his longtime goal of revising Japan's post-war constitution. Abe's party and its nationalist supporters have advocated constitutional revisions for years. They view the 1947 constitution as the legacy of Japan's defeat in World War II. The charter renounces the use of force in international conflicts and limits Japan's troops to self-defense, although Japan has a well-equipped modern military that works closely with the United States.Abe said, I hope to put an end to the debate in my generation whether the self-defense forces troops, which are currently working hard 24 hours, 365 days amidst the tension over North Korea, is constitutional or not.Any change to Japan's constitution, which has never been amended, requires approval first by two-thirds of parliament and then in a public referendum. Polls indicate that the Japanese public remains opposed to the amendment. We invite you to read more on our top story by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia. We're also on Facebook, VOA Asia, and the voanews.com website.These are among the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. The Japanese leader appears to be successful in a snap election there. Indonesia seeks answers as one of its generals is denied entry to the United States. Philippine troops battle the last of the Marawi militants. Bangladesh and India express some differences of opinion when it comes to Rohingya refugees. And rangers have discovered new evidence of one of Australia's rarest and most mysterious birds. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website.VOA Asia continues now. India said Sunday, that the Rohingya refugee crisis in southern Bangladesh will only be solved when the Rohingya people can return home to Myanmar. India's Foreign Minister Sushma Swaraj made the comments during a visit to Dhaka, Bangladesh, to discuss the situation with her Bangladeshi counterpart, A.H. Mahmud Ali.
I may add that India is deeply concerned at this situation.In Rakhine state of Myanmar. We have urged that the situation be handled with restraint, keeping in mind the welfare of the population. Friends, it is clear that normalcy will only be restored with the return of the displaced persons to Rakhine state. In our view, the only long-term solution to the situation in Rakhine state is rapid socio-economic and infrastructure development that would have a positive impact on all the communities living in the state.
Sushma added that the only long-term solution to the crisis is for rapid socioeconomic and infrastructure development for Rohingya Muslims living in Myanmar's Rakhine State, as you just heard. Suarez said India has committed to provide financial and technical assistance for identified projects to be undertaken in Rakhine State in conjunction with the local authorities, but also expressed concern about what it apparently sees as possible terrorist penetration of some of the Rohingya community. In that same news conference, the Bangladesh foreign minister urged India to contribute toward exerting sustained pressure on Myanmar to find a peaceful solution to the situation.
We were happy to be reassured that India would continue to support the humanitarian cause related to Rohingyas in Bangladesh. We thank India for humanitarian assistance provided for Rohingyas. We further urged India to contribute towards exerting sustained pressure on Myanmar to find a peaceful solution to the crisis, including sustainable return of all Rohingyas to their homeland.
According to the United Nations, 589,000 refugees have arrived in Bangladesh since 25th of August, when Myanmar security forces began a scorched earth campaign against Rohingya villages. Myanmar refutes accusations its army has targeted civilians and says it was responding to attacks on its personnel. We want to find out about maybe some friction between India and Bangladesh when it comes to the Rohingya crisis. And we welcome to VOA Asia Michael Kugelman, who is Senior Associate of the South Asia Program at the Wilson Center in Washington, and he's now Deputy Director of the Asia Program there. Michael, what is this tension all about?
Well, I think the main issue here is that India has a conservative government that has pitched itself as very tough on terror, and particularly Islamist terror. So I think that the government in India is very sensitive to a number of reports coming from the Indian intelligence agencies, some of them I think more credible than others, that suggest that the Rohingya are susceptible to being recruited by the likes of ISIS or also Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is a Pakistani terrorist organization. And, you know, to be sure, I think everyone could agree that the Rohingya are an extremely marginalized community. And, you know, this is not a terrorist threat. But India is very attuned to these reports that its own intelligence agency has put out. And I think that for that reason, that puts it at odds with the likes of Bangladesh, which, of course, is in a position where it has to be hosting this huge number, you know, a million or whatever it is, of these Rohingya that have come in over the last year. And Bangladesh has been much more conciliatory in its language, I think in part to as a gesture to its Muslim population, and particularly to Islamist political forces that would not want to see the government being critical of this very marginalized ethnic Muslim community coming into Bangladesh. So I think that, you know, when we want to talk about the different positions we may be hearing from each of these sides, I think what it comes down to is that for India, it needs to think about what it describes or what it projects as the potential for a terrorist threat from this community, which in my own view is a big mistake and is very unfortunate. This is what it comes down to.
That position is, of course, the one that Myanmar is taking, that this poses an existential terrorist threat. And that seems to be the motivation, at least their reason for doing what they have done, correct?
Yeah, this is exactly right, that, you know, the Myanmar regime essentially describes the Rohingya as terrorists. And, of course, that comes from the fact that you do have this very small insurgent group in Myanmar that includes Rohingya that have been fighting against the state. But why are they fighting against the state? It's in response to this incredibly heavy level of repression and violence that's been meted out onto the Rohingya community in Myanmar. I mean, this insurgent group, known as ARSA, its acronym, is not an Islamist terror group. You know, let's make that very clear. It's a local insurgency that's animated by purely local grievances that relate to how the state treats the Rohingya community so poorly. But yeah, unfortunately, you're right that when the Indians try to highlight what they may describe as terrorist threats emanating from the Rohingya community, they're essentially emulating the same lines that are coming from from the Myanmar regime.
Nevertheless, they decided to send one of their top officials to Dhaka to meet and express feelings about the situation with that person's counterpart in the Bangladesh government. Why would they do that, and why would they continue to help funding, which is apparently what they're doing, some of the services that are being provided to the Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh?
Well, I think India wants to project itself as a responsible state and as a responsible neighbor. It's Bangladesh's neighbor, and these are two countries that have had somewhat of a difficult time of it in terms of diplomatic relations over the last few years, though these relations have improved in more recent years. And, India does host its own modest community of Rohingya. I mean, the numbers are not anything near what they are in Bangladesh. But it's hosting its own Rohingya community. So I think that, even whereas India may focus on what it describes as a terrorist threat emanating from the Rohingya community, at the same time, it doesn't want to come across as purely irresponsible and sound like, this dictatorial state in Myanmar. I think that it wants to try to present somewhat of a balanced and a more modest position toward the Rohingya. And so I think that's why, you're having these meetings between the Indians and the Bangladeshis to describe or to discuss these issues.
Michael Kugelman is senior associate of the South Asia program at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., and is also deputy director of the Asia program. Michael, as always, thanks so much. Happening now in Asia, Japan's leader will push reform of Japan's pacifist constitution after his apparent election win. A typhoon kills at least two in Japan and prompts a call for thousands to evacuate. Indonesia demands answers after a military chief is denied U.S. entry. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Thanks so much for being with us. At China's Communist Party Congress this week, a meeting of the country's autocratic government held every 5 years, President Xi Jinping said the country would be a contributor to global development. Key to that is the so-called One Belt, One Road initiative. It seeks to rekindle ancient Silk Road trade routes linking China with Europe and Africa. Billions of dollars have been plowed into infrastructure projects along the route. But as Henry Ridgewell reports, there are calls for China to focus on development goals such as alleviating poverty.
Running 1,300 kilometers over the world's highest mountain pass, the so-called Friendship or Karakoram Highway is evidence of China's willingness to spend big. Costing tens of billions of dollars, the road links Western China with Pakistan, part of Beijing's One Belt, One Road initiative, a central tenet of President Xi's leadership, says Professor Steve Tsang of London's School of Oriental and African Studies.
The government is committed to do whatever it can to make sure that it is successful. So a lot more money and resources will be put into it to support that.
But figures show since the Karakoram Highway was built, Pakistani exports to China have actually fallen, while imports have increased, raising concern China's new Silk Road could become a one-way street. Stephen Gelb of the Overseas Development Institute says Beijing should focus its investments on global development goals.
At the moment, there's a lot of focus on infrastructure and particularly transport, pipelines, that sort of thing, which don't directly address poverty. And in fact, there's been in some cases some controversy about the social and environmental impacts. But I think the aim should be to address development, including poverty and related issues.
Think about it.
Gliding above the choking road traffic of the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa, the Chinese-funded tramway system opened last year at a cost of $500 million. Beijing says investments like this will boost African economies, thereby alleviating poverty. Gelb says it is also part of China's plan to become a dominant force on the global stage.
That was affirmed in Xi Jinping's speech. China is very much about these days rules-based global governance, multilateralism, globalization.
Visiting India this week, US Secretary of State Rex Tillerson accused China of not always playing by those rules.
China, while rising alongside India, has done so less responsibly, at times undermining the international rules-based order.
Recipient countries have welcomed Chinese investment, which sometimes comes with fewer conditions than Western aid, such as demands for democratic reform. But Professor Steve Tsang warns there could be a sting in the tail.
The real issue will come when some of those countries, particularly in Central Asia, have to pay back some of the loans that were accrued in the Belt and Road Initiative. And most of those countries will have problems paying back those loans.
For now, Chinese investment continues to expand. Development campaigners say Beijing's focus should be not only on ports and pipelines, but on tackling poverty. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
Jazz America!
This is Russ Davis, the host for Jazz America, where each week we give you the best of jazz past and present and conversation with the music makers. You can hear the program online at voanews.com and on the air on VOA each Saturday and Sunday at 13 hours Universal Time. Join me for Jazz America and help me celebrate the greatness of a century of jazz. Listen at 13 hours Universal Time, Saturdays and Sundays, on voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This news alert now from VOA Asia. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe appears to have swept to a resounding victory in a snap election. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter says he is willing to travel to North Korea. India says a way must be found to return Rohingyas to Myanmar. You can visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. A powerful typhoon roared toward Japan's main island Monday, killing at least two people and bringing heavy rain to western Japan. Typhoon Lan, classified as an intense Category 4 storm by the Tropical Storm Risk Monitoring Site, is packing wind gusts up to 198 kilometers per hour. It is on track to make landfall on the Pacific coast of central Japan before dawn Monday and continue northeast toward Tokyo. It's already done that, obviously. The storm has already forced the evacuation of thousands along coastal areas, disrupted train services, and forced the cancellation of 300 flights. The Japan Meteorological Agency issued warnings for heavy rain and flooding on the Pacific side of Japan, including the Tokyo metropolitan area, even though the typhoon is likely to be downgraded. So far, at least two deaths have been reported in the storm. Several parts of Japan have already recorded rainfall totals greater than 500 millimeters over the past 72 hours. This news alert from VOA Asia. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, according to reports, has swept to a comfortable victory in Sunday elections. At least two people are reported dead in the wake of a powerful typhoon that hit central Japan. The sixth day of the Chinese Communist Party's five-yearly Congress is expected to hand President Xi Jinping a second five-year term. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Despite laws banning child marriage, rights groups in Pakistan say the problem continues, partly because of a desire to follow tradition and partly because of poverty. No matter the reason, development experts say early marriage hurts the education and health prospects for girls. Sahar Majid brings us this report, done by Saman Khan from VOA's Urdu service in Lahore.
He used to beat me up a lot. I got scars on my body. He would really beat me up. 16-year-old Asma was married to a 40-year-old man who demanded that she take care of his four children from a previous marriage. He divorced her, however, and kicked her out of the house when she was just 17. I used to do all the chores, would raise his children, cook food, clean the house, but he would say that I did not do enough. After the divorce, Asma, who suffers from a muscle weakening disorder, went home to her mother and stepfather. I thought she would go to her husband's house and would be better off financially. I didn't know that she would come back and become an unwanted burden on us. Pakistan bans child marriages and, in 2015, Punjab province strengthened the ban with tougher punishments. Yet, the Aurat Foundation, a Pakistan women's rights group, says the problem persists.
There is a need to educate those who conduct the marriage contract that if they conduct a marriage ceremony for anyone under the age of 16, they would be punished.
The Punjab Commission for Women says marriages of minors often are held as private agreements between two families, so many marriages are not recorded.
There's still a lot to do because people don't think it's wrong. They are carrying on with their traditions. Only 6 cases surfaced during 2016, but the remaining cases were never registered.
The United Nations calls child marriage a problem for much of the world that harms the health and education of girls and their families.
If we marry a 16-year-old girl, she becomes pregnant at a young age. This increases the rate of deaths of young mothers. And this is exactly why we cannot fulfill our commitments for sustainable development goals. We still have high rates of mortality in mothers and infants. This is why many children die before their 5th birthday.
Activists here say ending child marriage is difficult. Many families marry off daughters because they can't afford to care for them. And other parents see child marriage as a way to uphold traditions or build bonds with other families. For Saman Khan of VOA's Urdu service in Lahore, I'm Sahar Majid, VOA News.
You are listening to VOA Asia from the Voice of America. Aboriginal rangers have discovered some new evidence of one of Australia's rarest and most mysterious birds. The night parrot was feared extinct until it was spotted in 2013. There have been precious few sightings since, but Indigenous wildlife rangers say they have photographed one of the nocturnal ground-dwelling birds in the Kimberley region of Western Australia. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has more.
It's just an indistinct flash of pale green and yellow captured on a motion sensor camera, but experts believe Aboriginal rangers have found a new population of one of Australia's most elusive birds. The blurry image taken in Western Australia's Great Sandy Desert suggests the night parrot is fighting back from the brink of extinction. There's also an audio recording. Before 2013, scientists didn't know what the call sounded like. Then a night parrot was found in the state of Queensland. Until recently, the colourful bird hadn't been seen in Western Australia for more than 100 years. The mysterious night parrot, a nocturnal ground-dwelling creature, was thought to have died out due to a loss of habitat, bushfires and attacks by feral cats. The cats threatened the survival of more than 100 native species and are thought to have killed off a number of birds and smaller mammals. Alexander Watson, a biologist at conservation group WWF Australia, who's worked with Aboriginal rangers in the Great Sandy Desert of Western Australia, says it's an extraordinary discovery.
We brought equipment like sensor cameras and bioacoustic devices to listen for the night parrots. And extraordinarily, we've got a photo of a night parrot flying across one of the sensor cameras. It's a small green parrot with a yellow belly and large head. It could only be a night parrot. We surveyed in areas that the traditional owners knew there were night parrots there.
The night parrot is sacred to First Nation peoples, and experts say Australia now has a second chance to save a bird that was once thought to have died out. The exact locations of recent sightings are being kept secret to protect the recently discovered populations. Researchers hope that more of these mysterious birds will soon be found in other parts of Australia. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud. Download our podcast and take VOA Asia with you. You can find us at voanews.com. Let us hear from you, VOA Asia Facebook, and our email, voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Aiden Oku, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, David Bird, Skylar Ogden. I'm Ira Melman. Enjoy your day.